From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Today, an update of news and events in Latin America and the Caribbean with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, reporting from Managua, Nicaragua.
Thanks a million, Don. Good to be back with you. A long time, no talk.
So first of all, I'm glad to hear you're not gurgling while we speak. You got bad hurricanes in the Caribbean. You got hit twice, right?
Yeah, we were hit by Hurricane Eta around, when was it? The kind of November the 10th, something like that. And then on November the 16th, we got hit by Hurricane Iota, and they were both Category 5 hurricanes when they hit Nicaragua's northeastern coast.
Ouch. Ouch. How did you guys fare through that?
Well, where I am in Esteli, we were very lucky because the Hurricane Eta, the first hurricane, hit the northeastern part of Nicaragua, caused a lot of damage, damaged a lot of housing infrastructure, road infrastructure, and then very quickly veered north into Honduras and started causing very widespread flooding, because by the time it got into Honduras, it had dropped a two or three categories down towards a tropical depression, tropical storm, but it still caused enormous damage in Honduras and Guatemala and El Salvador too, with landslides. There was a very bad landslide in Guatemala. And then just as people in Nicaragua thought, well, now we can start rebuild, they got hit in almost exactly the same place by Hurricane Iota, which was another Category 5 hurricane. And it just destroyed whole towns all along the northern Caribbean coast. And there's a place called Wawaba and another place called Hallover that were just completely wiped out. Hardly a house was left standing. And Bilwi itself, formerly known as Puerto Cabezas, now called Bilwi, that suffered extensive damage too, but thankfully not as bad as people feared. And then what Iota did was, it, instead of veering north into Honduras straight away like Eta did, it went straight across the northern part of Nicaragua, depositing lots of rain, torrential rain causing widespread flooding, both in Honduras again and also in southern Nicaragua that had largely escaped the worst effects of Eta. So now, Iota degraded very quickly to a tropical storm, but it still caused extensive flooding mainly in Guatemala and Honduras. So yeah, and the overall effect of that for us, I know here where I live in this part of northern Nicaragua, were relatively benign. There was very, very little flooding for us, but across the country there was extensive crop damage. A lot of communities were flooded out in the south of the country around Rivas and San Juan del Sur. But again, the thing about Nicaragua is that because we have this very strong socialist community-oriented government and system of government, they were taking precautions against the hurricanes many days before even Hurricane Eta hit. So the loss of life was minimal. I think just two people died during Hurricane Eta, and then about 20 to 25 people died here in Nicaragua during Hurricane Iota, but all as a result of flooding and landslides. And the same is true in Honduras and Guatemala. There was a very tragic landslide in Guatemala that killed a large number of people. I've forgotten the number, but it was a region-wide disaster, similar to Mitch back in 1998. Right. In fact, Iota was the strongest hurricane to hit Nicaragua and the region since 1988, or even before.
My goodness.
So, but the thing is that here in Nicaragua, that because they were prepared, they hold four national civil defense drills every year. So everybody knew what to do. Everybody took the measures that they knew would protect lives. And they also undertook procedures that were designed to protect infrastructure, like shutting down the power across the whole region likely to be affected by the hurricane. And I think in total they had, by the end, between Eta and Iota, they had a total of around 160,000 people in shelters over that period to protect them from the savage hurricane strength winds. And that was not the case in Honduras and Guatemala. In Honduras and Guatemala, there was a very poor response from the authorities in civil defense terms. And there seems to have been much more serious disruption, lasting disruption in Honduras and Guatemala than there has been here in Nicaragua. And in Nicaragua, they've already got the power back to about 98% of the country. You know, and
it's remarkable, really.
They methodically and systematically set about rebuilding bridges and repairing roads. So, in terms of getting back to normal life, Nicaragua has done somewhat better than its northern neighbors in Honduras and Guatemala.
So, these are the kinds of things where the type of system that's in place. I guess distinguishes one from another. You have the loss, said I think 6%, about 6% GDP damage from the storms.
Including all the damage, including environmental damage,
right,
is calculated at 6% of GDP.
Okay, and then say you have an annual growth rate on the average, say in the neighborhood of 5%, and so, you know, just growing your economy in the face of this type of disaster, if you had one of these every year, then everyone works their tail off and you're sliding behind 1%. And so then, of course, part and parcel of the whole process is you focus your effort, your economic activity on building, stronger infrastructure, more hurricane-resistant stuff, so that even if you keep getting hurricanes every year, and of course that's not the case, but even if you, whatever it is, you know, that the percentage of, you know, of loss per event is being reduced consistently, so that as you're building, more and more of what you built stays built.
Yeah, that's true. The infrastructure aspect is an important aspect, but also the loss of crops is an important aspect.
Yeah, for sure.
In Nicaragua, we were very, very lucky that we had a really excellent first harvest. So even with the extensive damage to crops across the north of the country caused by these two hurricanes and the flooding that they provoked, and Nicaragua is still going to be a net exporter of food to the region, despite quite significant loss of crops,
lucky timing? In other words, if it came earlier, it would have been worse?
In part, it's lucky timing. Also, in part, it's because Nicaragua's economic production model prioritizes small and medium-sized farms. So that across the country, a percentage of farmers may get hit, but there's plenty of slack in order for our farmers to take that up and make good any national losses in production. So
literally, you don't have all your eggs in one basket.
Absolutely, and that's also part of Nicaragua's economic democracy. Mm-hmm. And there are different kinds of democracy. People tend to focus on the elections. So in the United States and Europe, you have elections every 4 years.
They're so entertaining.
So entertaining, but not very democratic.
Yeah, correct.
And the economic democracy that we have here in Nicaragua, in my opinion, is far more substantial than the kind of economic democracy that you have in the United States or Western Europe. I mean, look at look at what the policy response has been to the COVID-19 pandemic. Right. You know, and what's happened in Western Europe and North America is that small businesses have been completely wiped out.
Right.
And in Nicaragua, what they did was they took a kind of focus, a strategy of focused protection that didn't shut down the economy, and that's enabled its economy, which is based on small businesses, especially small farming businesses, to keep going throughout the pandemic.
Right.
And that also has enabled Nicaragua to respond to economically to the hit from the hurricanes in a more positive way than its neighbors, because its neighbors in El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras and Costa Rica effectively shut down huge swathes of their economy. And that's made the impact of the hurricanes on their economy. It's compounded that economic damage.
Jeez, and there wasn't much more of that anyway.
The people are reasonably optimistic about the immediate outlook and the short and medium term outlook. In Honduras, and a lot of people are wondering what on earth they're going to do.
Well, while we're looking at this, Nicaragua's version of democracy, which is a very interesting one and a substantive one when you're talking about the meat and potatoes, literally, of people's lives. looking at Bolivia right now with the new government there, after the coup, after all of the things that they did to suppress the democratic government there, it was so far, it's been showing some considerable resilience. You want to talk about what's been going on there?
Yeah, as I've said before, I'm by no means an expert on Bolivia in any shape or form, but you can see the broad outlines of recovery under the new government of Luis Arce. And one of the measures that they took recently was they just appointed a minister specially to deal with the agricultural economy of the country. And that's a sign that they recognize that the small and medium-sized farmer sector of Bolivia is a crucial part of the country's economy that they have to prioritize in order to have a successful recovery from the lamentable effects of the coup government.
Right.
And they've done things like, they're rejoining ALBA, they're rejoining UNISUR, so they're promoting that whole agenda of regional integration, respecting different countries' political systems, but insisting on the importance of regional integration to strengthen all the countries' national economies by working together. So that in itself is very positive and optimistic, only gives it cause for a lot of optimism. And one of the things that surprised me about the policies that the new government is instigating is that I expected them to go for some kind of amnesty for all the crimes committed by the armed forces and the police under the coup regime, and they're not following that option, which is the one that was taken here in Nicaragua after the failed coup attempt in 2018, and they really are going after the coup leaders, several of whom have left the country and gone to the United States and elsewhere in Latin America. But apparently, the woman Jeanine Añez, who was the de facto president under the coup regime, and it looks as though she's going to be prosecuted by the new Bolivian authorities, and it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yes,
and whether it may lead to more instability or in fact consolidate stability. It's not clear to me how that's going to pan out, because people like Luis Camacho, the extreme fascist leader in the province of Santa Cruz, and he's still very active and he has a lot of support. And who also has a lot of support in the armed forces and perhaps in the police too. So it's not clear to me at the moment how the government's process of bringing the criminals of the coup regime to justice is going to work out. But obviously they're doing that because there's a strong demand from the people that support the government for justice to be not just done, but seen to be done.
Yeah, it needs to be seen by the people who might try this next time. That's the first thing you want to do is discourage this kind of illegal activity. And you do that by prosecuting it where you see it.
Right. Yeah, the danger of more instability from those extreme right wing fascist forces in Bolivia is always there. So it'll be interesting to see how the new Bolivian authorities manage that. And I think they will, but I don't envy them. They have a very difficult task ahead in terms of both rebuilding their economy and of maintaining social and political stability in the country.
Yeah.
And you can see that. You can see that elsewhere. And in Guatemala, returning to Central America briefly, in Guatemala there have been very serious street protests, somewhat different to the protests in 2015. Mm. Which led to the overthrow of that guy, Otto, what's his name? I've forgotten the president's name. They're all so forgettable. But that led to the overthrow of that guy and the eventual election of Jimmy Morales, the former comedian. And now Jimmy Morales has given way to a new president following last year's elections, or a guy called Jim Atay. But he too now has fallen foul of popular opinion because his government has tried to push through a budget that has very serious consequences for Guatemala's ability to maintain adequate levels of social spending. And so there are huge protests against that. And then you see a similar situation in Peru. It seems to me that there are a couple of things going on in the region. One is this continuing widespread undercurrent of popular resentment and revolt. And you can see it in Guatemala, you can see it in Peru, you can see it in Haiti, you can see it in Colombia, massive demonstrations out in the streets against the governments of all those countries. So you have that political process going on, and you also have this process of elections. In countries like Venezuela, and next weekend in Venezuela, we have these very important legislative elections, which everyone believes will see a significant change in the composition of Venezuela's National Assembly, that will be much more favorable to the current government of President Nicolas Maduro, even though his party, the ruling Venezuelan Party of Socialist Unity, PSUV, is running against another very progressive political option, electoral option, led by Venezuela's Communist Party. But despite that apparent division, it's very unlikely that the right wing are going to be able to organize to win a significant number of seats in that election, mainly because a big chunk of the right-wing opposition under the influence of the United States is boycotting the elections. Yeah. But even the moderate opposition in Venezuela are unlikely to do very well, and so the government is likely to come out well of those legislative elections, which will mean a much more stable political situation in the country than there's been since 2015, when the right wing had that huge win in the legislative elections of that year. And also in a couple of months, 2.5 months time, you've got the elections in Ecuador, which the government of Lenin Moreno is doing its utmost to try and stall.
Yeah, for sure. We're talking about February 7th, I think, right?
Yeah. What is it, February the 11th? Something
the
like
7th,
that.
Yeah.
February the 7th. So, what's that? 2 months away, in effect.
Yeah.
So, So the leader of the Union for Hope party, which is the party that is looking to capitalize on the extraordinary success prior to the election of Lenin Moreno, of Rafael Correa's government, the citizen power government of Rafael Correa. And Andrés Arauz is a very young politician with a lot of support from all the political groups that support Rafael Correa. And on current showing, it looks as though he's likely to do very well and win those presidential elections in Ecuador in February. But the government of Lenin Moreno is doing everything they can to stall the process and make it and stop Andrés Arauz and his ticket running in the elections. It remains to be seen whether Moreno will succeed in doing that. But the point about it is that those electoral processes are in very strong contrast to the street protests in countries like Guatemala, Haiti, Colombia, and so on.
Right.
And there's every chance that progressive forces will do very well in those elections. And there also you have this, which is part of the same phenomenon, in my opinion. You have this constituent assembly process that is there are going to be elections to the constituent assembly process in Chile in early April. I think the date is April the 11th. And so you, at the same time as you have these strong street protests against right-wing government across the region, you have these electoral processes in which progressive forces across the region are likely to do very well. And so, you know, and that's... Those are the two things that we probably need to be looking at over the next month or so, and that, you know, what else is going on? And in general, and I think that those two processes, the process of street protest and the process of progressive advance in the electoral processes that are coming up over the next 2 or 3 months. Particularly the legislative elections in Venezuela, and they show very much that all this talk about pink tides and so on, and they don't explain anything about what's going on really, and what is really going on. You have this absolutely relentless push by previously excluded majorities to find it political and economic and social expression, and the right wing have no answer.
Right.
You know, and the progress of the Bolivian government is an expression of that.
Yep.
And the people across the continent who support the right wing agenda really thought that the Bolivian coup government represented some kind of significant change. Well, it didn't.
Right.
It didn't represent any change at all, because the underlying process is not going away. People are always going to demand, the excluded majority are always going to demand a better life. And the right wing in Latin America may delay that, but there's nothing that they can do to stop that happening.
Right. Yep, people go to bed hungry, but they wake up in the morning again, and if they're still hungry, they're going to get up and do something about it.
Right.
You know, and
I think you're likely to see that process in Central America, and one of the reasons that there are protests against the government in Guatemala is because the Guatemalans have made a very poor response to the crisis, the humanitarian crisis provoked by the hurricanes. Right. And you're likely to see a similar reaction in El Salvador,
right,
and a similar reaction in Honduras.
Right.
And again, one of the countries that I left out in the list of countries where there are persistent and very strong street protests was Costa Rica.
Right.
The very strong protests in Costa Rica, where the government is trying to impose an agenda promoted by the IMF.
And that's unusual, isn't it, for Costa Rica? It's not the norm, put it that way.
No, and it just goes to show how much that right-wing agenda, the structural adjustment agenda, the neoliberal IMF agenda, and it's completely discredited. Even in Costa Rica, people are sick of it.
So, meanwhile, there's movement towards having a constituent assembly in the Chilean elections in April, right? And you've had a break. The interesting thing with China and Venezuela, China's essentially been flipping the bird to U.S. sanctions and starting to do business with Venezuela in a number of ways, particularly with oil. And that has some very promising, it suggests some very promising developments over the near term. What do you have to think about what's going on with that?
Sure, I think we have to link it to what's happening globally, because in the same way that in a regional sense, the impoverished excluded majorities are just not going to give up. They are going to continue demanding a decent life.
Right.
And at a global level, the global majority, the countries like China, the Russian Federation, and all these countries, and you can see it in Iran, for example, and the United States and its allies can continue to murder Iranian scientists as much. Do they really think that's going to stop Iran progressing to a level of scientific and technological achievement that will enable the people of Iran to take their place, their rightful place, among the leading technological nations of the world? Of course they can't.
Of course not. As a matter of fact, you end up seeing Iran flipping the bird to American sanctions also and trading with Venezuela and vice versa.
Yeah, and Iran says Venezuela's bacon this year, sending it half a dozen tanker loads of fuel.
Yep.
And equipment to restore Venezuela's refining capacity that the United States has been trying to cripple for years. It seems to me that what we're seeing in a global sense, Don, as well, is another expression of what we're seeing in a regional sense. The United States and its allies can impose all the sanctions that they like, but over the next 2-3 years, in the short term, we're going to see that it's them that are going to be isolated. Right?
That's right.
It's not Iran. I know you're going to isolate China, for goodness sake.
I know exactly. Well, you know what it reminds me of? I don't know how far back, how old this is, maybe even back to vaudeville or earlier. But the image is of, you have the two husbands in some sitcom who are going to paint the floors in the house for the first time. And, you know, you see they start the job and then the camera goes elsewhere. And when it comes back, they're both stuck in the opposite corners of the room. They painted themselves into a corner. This is the U.S. They're sanctioning the entire world, and there's a point in time when there's no one left to sanction, and they're by themselves. And they've been working on that project a long time, so it's moved pretty far along. And we got to stop here. We're completely out of time, Tony, but I will speak with you again next week, and thank you so much.
You're very welcome, Don. Look forward to talking to you again.
Thanks.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.